You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Folks, if you're an entrepreneur, a small business owner, or even if you have a side gig, let me introduce you to Grasshopper, the entrepreneur's phone system. Grasshopper lets you send and receive calls and texts from your new business phone number. That way, you can run your business from anywhere and respond to clients quickly with Grasshopper's mobile apps. Grasshopper, sign up today. Go to grasshopper.com/kick to get $20 off your first month. Again, that's grasshopper.com/kick. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Of the 260 or so episodes I've done on Kick-Ass News, one of the most popular ones was a two-part interview I did with physicist, futurist, and number one best-selling author, Professor Michio Kaku. For me, it was also one of the funnest interviews I've done because Michio has a stunning breadth of knowledge about new and emerging technology and an infectious enthusiasm for what's coming next and for the potential of science to dramatically improve our world in the coming decades. So I'm thrilled to welcome Michio Kaku back to the show to talk about his latest book, The Future of Humanity: Terraforming Mars, Interstellar Travel, Immortality, and Our Destiny Beyond Earth. Today, he says sooner or later, humanity will face the possibility of extinction, and it's up to scientists to get us out of that jam by coming up with a plan B, whether it's another planet or even another galaxy. He explains why it's important for us to finally return to the moon, how we would go about terraforming Mars to make it habitable for humans, and what he calls the new gold rush that could turn NASA into a self-funding agency. He shares his theory on why we haven't encountered alien life, and part of it has to do with where we fall on his hierarchy of civilizations. In fact, Michio says we haven't even made it on the list, and a large part of it has to do with Earth's 1.0 approach to energy. Plus, Michio describes the three ways the universe will almost certainly die, but suggests that in the meantime, immortality may be just around the corner. He weighs in on the rise of space entrepreneurs like Elon Musk. And finally, he gives me a progress update on what he calls his life's work, proving Einstein's unified theory of everything. Coming up with futurist Michio Kaku in just a moment. Michio Kaku is a professor of physics at the City University of New York, co-founder of string field theory, and the author of several widely acclaimed science books, including Beyond Einstein, The Future of the Mind, Hyperspace, Physics of the Future, and Physics of the Impossible. He's the science correspondent for CBS This Morning and host of the radio programs Science Fantastic and Exploration. He's written a new book called The Future of Humanity: Terraforming Mars, Interstellar Travel, Immortality, and Our Destiny Beyond Earth. Professor Michio Kaku, welcome back to the podcast.
Glad to be on the show.
Well, Michio, you are my favorite futurist because you're always so optimistic. But I have to say that some aspects of this book border on being slightly depressing because all of the science and tech you're talking about in the future of humanity are driven by the goal of avoiding our inevitable demise and even extinction. Is that going to be the thing that motivates us to explore the universe and make other breakthroughs in this book?
Well, you know, the dinosaurs did not have a space program. And that's why they're not here today. An asteroid or comet wiped them out 65 million years ago. But we do have a space program. We have the option of creating an insurance policy, a plan B by going into outer space. Now, I once talked to Carl Sagan, the astronomer, and he said that, well, the Earth is in the middle of a cosmic shooting gallery. with thousands of meteors and asteroids whizzing by, and sooner or later, one of them is going to have our number on it. Now, he didn't say we should evacuate the Earth to go to Mars. That's too much effort. And on the other hand, we shouldn't leave the Earth to escape global warming. That's a problem that we have to cure on Earth. We're Earthlings on the Earth. We got to cure global warming. However, he said that we should have a settlement on Mars just in case something bad happens, a supervolcano, asteroid, a collision. And remember that 75,000 years ago, a supervolcano erupted in Indonesia, which wiped out almost all humans. Only a handful, a few hundred of us, survived that cataclysm to repopulate the entire Earth. Now, I think about this every day. Think about it for a moment. A few hundred of us survived that cataclysm to repopulate the entire Earth 75,000 years ago. If that happens again, we're done for.
You actually start off by spending several chapters in the beginning looking at the evolution of the space program and rocket propulsion. You point out that during the Cold War, whenever NASA needed funding, the administrator just went before Congress and said one word, Russia, and the money spigot would flow. Has NASA had trouble articulating their case for funding since the end of the Cold War?
Yeah, for 50 years, people criticized NASA as being the agency to nowhere. The wind in the sails of NASA was the Cold War. And remember, in 1966, the NASA budget was 5% of the entire federal budget. Now, think about that.
Wow.
5% of every tax dollar that went to the government went to the space program. That was unsustainable. And that's why for 50 years we were spinning wheels. Now times have changed. Prices have dropped dramatically. You know the movie The Martian? Most people have seen that movie with Matt Damon, right?
Yeah, great movie.
That movie cost $100 million. But you know, the Indians sent a space probe to Mars for $70 million. You realize, therefore, that it costs more money for Hollywood to make a movie about going to Mars than actually going to Mars. They should give an Oscar for the best supporting spacecraft. That's how cheap space travel has become.
Now, you have some ideas for how NASA could eventually become a self-funding agency, and so they wouldn't have to come hat in hand to Congress every year. One of these ideas involves mining asteroids. Okay, what would we find in them? How would we do it? And how much money are we talking about?
Well, we talked about Silicon Valley billionaires underwriting the cost, hoping to become famous and get profits in the future. Tesla Motors and Elon Musk are backing the Falcon moon rocket. Amazon, with Jeff Bezos, is backing a spaceport in Texas. And now Google is now jumping in the game.
Even Google.
Yes, they're backing Planetary Resources to mine the asteroids. And guess who set that into motion? It was President Barack Obama. He said that, well, Mars is kind of far away, but asteroids could become very close to us, and they're full of platinum-rich minerals that are valuable for the electronics industry, like rare earths. So the idea was to basically grab an asteroid and bring it back to Earth. An asteroid about 50 feet across contains about $50 billion worth of platinum-based metals and rare earths necessary for the electronics industry. It could pay for itself.
I'm trying to think. It was a couple of weeks ago that, of all people, I think the Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, had this idea about mining the moon, and a lot of people made fun of it. Some scientists said that it wasn't logistically possible to do what he was trying to do. What did you think about that?
Well, we're thinking about mining Mars. Forget
okay.
the moon.
Yeah, forget the moon. You're on the
first of
next
all,
level.
Mars has lots of ice, tremendous amounts of ice. We now know that the moon also has large quantities of ice in the shadow of mountains and craters. We didn't know that before. Now, why do you need water? Because, first of all, water can be purified for drinking water on these celestial bodies. Second of all, you can separate water into hydrogen and oxygen. Oxygen for breathing, hydrogen for rocket fuel. Think about that.
Okay.
By taking the ice from Mars, melting it, separating it out, you can create water for drinking, oxygen for breathing, hydrogen for rocket fuel, and then water for agriculture. So in outer space, water is worth more than oil. I mean, oil is useless in outer space because you can't burn oil. There's no oxygen in outer space. So oil is useless in outer space, but water would be extremely useful and valuable in outer space.
The private sector seems to be picking up some of the slack for NASA now that we have billionaires like Elon Musk and Richard Branson getting in the game. Do you welcome space entrepreneurship, or do you have concerns about that?
Oh, yeah. These space entrepreneurs are dropping the price of space travel like a rock. You know, last month, millions of people were riveted on TV watching the launch of the Falcon Heavy rocket. Now, why? Why were thousands of people lined up on the streets of Cape Canaveral, millions watching it on the internet? Because that rocket was a moon rocket. For the first time in 50 years, think about that.
Yeah.
For the first time in 50 years, a moon rocket took off from Cape Canaveral. And guess who paid for it? The taxpayers? You? Me? No. It was a private individual, Elon Musk. And now, Jeff Bezos, the richest man on Earth. Not to be outdone. He's jumped into the game. He wants to foot the bill for a spaceport in Texas. It's already operational. He wants to send fleets of ships to the moon and eventually create an Amazon delivery system to the moon.
You're kidding.
Think astronauts will be able to order an Amazon book while they're on the moon. That's how cheap space travel has become because, A, we're getting better at it. The Chinese, the Indians are now jumping into the game. The Chinese want to put their flag on the moon, by the way.
Right.
And second of all, because private enterprise, all these Silicon Valley billionaires had this dream that they had as children to conquer outer space and go to the stars.
Yeah, and you mentioned that it's been almost 50 years since humans set foot on the moon. Why has it been such a long gap, and why is it suddenly a priority again now?
Well, let's be blunt about this. Space travel used to be extremely expensive. To put a pound of anything in orbit, like a book, to put a pound of anything in orbit around the Earth cost $10,000 per pound.
Wow.
That's your weight in gold. Think of your body made out of solid gold, and that's what it costs to put you in orbit. Now, in the future, space travel is going to become relatively easy so that our grandkids could honeymoon on the moon. Think about that. Our grandkids may not want to simply look at the moon at night and wonder, gee, isn't it beautiful tonight? No, they're going to honeymoon on the moon. It's only three days away.
Do you think it's a very romantic or sexy place for a honeymoon, Michio?
Well, it's going to be a tourist site. I tell you, it's going to be a tourist site. Already, our astronauts played golf on the moon.
Yeah.
So we're going to have interplanetary sports on the moon. And of course, Mars is farther away.
Right.
Not just 3 days, but a round trip could be 2 years, for example. So the initial group of settlers will be pretty hardy. They will be astronauts. They will be fearless. They'll be test pilots, the first batch. After that, yeah, perhaps even tourists will go to Mars.
And when you go into this eventual idea of terraforming Mars, what would that look like? What would it take to make it hospitable enough for humans to be able to, let's say, walk around like we were walking the streets of New York without a space suit?
Well, of course, this is going to take time. We're talking about decades and decades of work. But the first thing you do is, well, mine the ice for rocket fuel and oxygen.
Right.
Create a Mars base by taking the Martian soil and solidifying it into brick. We've experimented with Martian soil on the Earth. And we've actually made bricks out of it. So you can make structures. Then what you want to do is inject methane gas to start a greenhouse effect. Solar satellites will eventually beam energy down to the polar ice caps of Mars and melt the ice so that water will flow freely on the surface of Mars after 3 billion years. Mars once had an ocean the size of the United States of America. It had seas, it had riverbeds, it had deltas. It was teeming with different kinds of aquatic formations that we find here on the planet Earth. And so if you melt the polar ice caps, you can reestablish the lakes and rivers and oceans of Mars.
And then you would be able to have breathable oxygen?
That's right. We want to import crops.
Okay.
Genetically modified algae that could thrive in these seas. They love carbon dioxide. The atmosphere of Mars is carbon dioxide. And what do they give off? Life-giving oxygen. And so we can then begin to create an oxygen atmosphere by importing genetically modified crops that love carbon dioxide and spew off tremendous amounts of breathable oxygen.
Okay, so the takeaway is that global warming can be a good thing, huh?
Well, on the Earth, it's a bad thing. We are terraforming terraforming the Earth. Terraforming is not an alien concept. We're doing it to the Earth right now for worse. But for better, we can terraform Mars.
With terraforming Mars, I mean, we've seen, like you just said, the consequences here on Earth. Could this sort of thing, monkeying with the environment on Mars, could it have unintended consequences?
Well, we got to do it carefully. Yeah. Elon Musk was asked about that question because he wants to colonize Mars with 1 million settlers. And he was asked about the polar ice caps. And he said, nuke them. That is, place a hydrogen bomb on the ice caps to melt the ice caps. Later, he qualified it. But I think that's not such a good idea.
You sure Donald Trump didn't say that?
No, it was Elon Musk. I think we should have mirrors from outer space beam the sunlight down to the ice caps rather than nuking the ice caps with nuclear weapons, which is doable. But who wants to drink radioactive water?
Now, if you were a betting man, who would you say is likely to get to Mars first, NASA or the private sector?
Well, gee, that's a toss-up because, you know, the NASA has its own moon rocket. We have not one, but two moon rockets now. This is unheard of. Who would have thought? First is the SLS. That's the NASA rocket. Mm-hmm. It costs $1 billion per launch. Wow. And every launch will be once every 1 or 2 years. Then we have Elon Musk, who says, bah, humbug. What is this billion-dollar launch business? He wants to get it down to 10%. 10% of the launch costs of the SLS with the Falcon Heavy. And he wants to launch these every few months, not wait 1 year per launch. So who's going to go to Mars first? Well, it's not clear. But if Elon Musk can deliver, we're going to go to Mars a lot sooner than the Washington bureaucrats.
How would you get it to 10% of that cost?
Well, it's reusable rockets. Okay. You know, after World War II, GIs came back from the war broke. They couldn't afford cars, but something happened. The usable, reused car market opened up, and all of a sudden, teenagers had cars. A whole culture revolved around used cars. Now, more used cars are sold than new cars. Think of it for the rockets now. Right now, rockets are not reusable, but Elon Musk proved that you can do it. And so this means that in the future, we'll reduce the cost maybe by a factor of 10 by having reused rockets.
Yeah, but if you buy a lemon with a rocket, it could cost your life.
You have to test it. And sure enough, when Elon Musk last month launched the Falcon Heavy, you saw it, two, not one. Two booster rockets came down vertically. This is like a science fiction movie. Two rockets came down vertically and landed softly on the launch pad. I mean, this is historic if you think about it. A new milestone in rocketry. Reusable rockets. Who would have thought?
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Professor Michio Kaku when we come back in just a moment. Hulu's newest original series, The Looming Tower, is based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning book by Lawrence Wright. This limited series traces the rising threat of Osama bin Laden and the rivalry between the FBI and CIA that may have set a path for the tragedy of 9/11. Starring Emmy winner Jeff Daniels, Golden Globe nominee Peter Sarsgaard, and Tahar Rahim as Ali Sufan. The Looming Tower, available now only on Hulu. Folks, you were just listening to scientist Michio Kaku talk on today's episode about how humanity needs a backup plan in the event of a cataclysmic disaster. He said Mars is Earth's insurance policy. But having a backup plan isn't just a good idea for whole planets, it's a good idea for people, too. If you have a car, you have car insurance. If you have a home, you have home insurance. If you're alive, shouldn't you have life insurance? 4 out of 10 people don't have life insurance at all. And it's not their fault. Shopping for life insurance is confusing and takes forever. So Policy Genius made it easy. Policy Genius is the easiest way to compare and buy life insurance. In just 5 minutes at policygenius.com, you can compare quotes from over 15 life insurance providers. And when you compare quotes, you save money. It's that simple. Plus, they don't just insure life, they insure everything in it. including health insurance, disability insurance, pet insurance, and renter's insurance. If you've been putting off getting life insurance, don't put it off any longer. It's never been easier to buy, and rates are at a 20-year low. So visit PolicyGenius.com, the easy way to compare and buy life insurance. If you're an entrepreneur, a small business owner, or even if you have a side gig, let me introduce you to Grasshopper, the entrepreneur's phone system. Grasshopper lets you run your business from your cell phone while keeping your business and personal lives separate. Choose from their huge inventory of local, toll-free, and vanity toll-free numbers. Simply forward your new number to your mobile phone and start taking calls immediately. Whether you're in an office, in your car, or out shopping, Grasshopper's iPhone and Android apps help you stay connected to your customers. Not to mention, you can send and receive calls and texts from your business phone number, set up multiple extensions for everyone on your team, get your voicemails transcribed and emailed to you, work from anywhere with call forwarding, make and receive calls from your computer via the desktop app, and even utilize Wi-Fi calling. Better yet, Grasshopper offers easy and instant setup and 24/7 customer support, all without any long-term contracts. Grasshopper, sign up today. Go to grasshopper.com/kick to get $20 off your first month. That's grasshopper.com/kick. What can your data tell you? With Google Cloud Platform, use machine learning at scale to build better products. Google Cloud's AI provides modern machine learning services with pre-trained models and a service to generate your own tailored models. Their platform is now available as a cloud service to bring unmatched scale and speed to your business applications. It predicts so your business can thrive. Click now to learn more about Google Cloud Platform. Visit g.co/getcloudai. Again, that's g.co/getcloudai. And now, back to the podcast.
Now, in the second section of the book, you discuss exploring the universe beyond our solar system. Unlike Mars, I'm assuming this won't happen in my lifetime. So how far out in the future are we talking, and what would that entail?
Well, my colleague Stephen Hawking wants to go to the stars, not 100 years from now. He wants to do it relatively soon, maybe 20 years. He's gotten another Silicon Valley billionaire to back the Breakthrough Starshot program. He wants to take a chip the size of a postage stamp, hook it up to a parachute, then inflate the parachute with a laser beam, maybe 100 billion watts of power, to shoot it to near the speed of light. In 20 years, not 100, 20 years, wow, we could be on Alpha Centauri. And so this is a doable dream, off-the-shelf technology. We're not talking Star Trek. We're not talking warp drive, though I discuss warp drive. We're talking about off-the-shelf technology sending computer chips to the nearby stars. We actually already have prototypes of these things that really? I show in my slideshow. It's about the size of a postage stamp, chock full of sensors, chock full of radio equipment and things that would allow it to whiz by Alpha Centauri and do telemetry, have sensor analysis of the planets, and then radio that information back. Now, Mother Nature has seeds, and she spews billions of seeds into the soil, and only a tiny, tiny fraction of them survive. That's nature's strategy. We should do the same thing with postage stamps. Send thousands of them to Alpha Centauri, hoping that one or two of them will make it and beam that information back to Earth.
And I think that you talk about in the book how we could potentially download our consciousness to one of these chips and somehow teleport ourselves, sort of. How would that work?
Yeah, I call this laser porting. And you realize that in the future, when you go to the library, instead of taking a book out about Winston Churchill, you'll talk to Winston Churchill. You'll talk to a hologram with all the mannerisms, all the vocabulary, all the anecdotes of Winston Churchill, because he's been digitized. Now, I wouldn't mind talking to Einstein.
Yeah.
I'd love an opportunity to talk to a digitized Einstein. And maybe one day we'll be digitized. So you'll talk to your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchild, wondering what did their great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather do, because we've been digitized. And then the question is that really you?
Well, yeah, that's what I wonder.
To paraphrase Bill Clinton, it all depends on how you define you. If you means a biological entity, then, well, you're talking to a tape recorder. Yeah. But if you represents everything known about your mannerisms, your thinking process, your vocabulary, your quirks, everything that has been digitized about you, then, yeah, you can put that on a laser beam and shoot it to the moon. So in 1 second, your consciousness is on the moon. In 4 years, your consciousness is on the stars.
Okay, so it would be like an AI program that simulates you on the data that
it has.
This
is called digital immortality. Okay. And in Silicon Valley, they're offering that now. Silicon Valley companies say that with a certain amount of money, we'll digitize you so that everything known about you will be available to your descendants.
I don't know if I would want that. I don't know that I would want to be trapped in a computer if I actually had... It was conscious.
Yeah, but you see, here's the deal. If you shoot your consciousness to the moon, there is a relay station which downloads your consciousness into a mainframe, then puts it into an avatar, a mechanical avatar that is super handsome, super strong, Superman, that could thrive on the moon, Mars, and outer space. We will be Superman and Superwomen rocketing across the universe at the speed of light. Now, let me stick my neck out. I think that this already exists.
Really?
I think that aliens from outer space, they're not going to use flying saucers. That's so 20th century flying saucers. They're going to laser port their consciousness by the billions across the universe at the speed of light. And there could be a highway, a laser highway right next to the Earth, beaming billions of souls. And we're too stupid to know it. We wouldn't know. We had no way of detecting this because we are so primitive in our technology.
So then I guess that would address the Fermi paradox, which is if there is intelligent life out there, how come we haven't encountered it yet?
Huh? Yeah, that's right. By the way, some people come up to me and say, bah, humbug. The Fermi paradox is ridiculous because I've been abducted. I've been kidnapped.
Oh really? You've encountered these
people? I've encountered a lot of these people. What do I tell them? I tell them the next time you're abducted by a UFO, steal something.
Yeah.
I don't care what it is. An alien chip, an alien paperweight, an alien pencil. Steal something. Because there's no law against stealing from an extraterrestrial being. There's no law. No one's going to put you
in
jail.
You're not protected.
And you have bragging rights. You say, I finally got a UFO pencil. Proof. Reproducible, testable, falsifiable evidence that I've been abducted.
What about, I've heard about these people who claim that they were abducted and they had something implanted under their skin that they dug out.
I
Do you
tell
know what
them,
I'm talking about?
I tell them, get that alien DNA.
Yeah.
That'll clinch it right there. It'll end the debate. End of story. Alien DNA. You realize what, incredible information could come out of alien DNA.
Yeah.
We had to rewrite history with alien DNA.
Yeah.
And it could be right in your, private parts, because that's where the aliens apparently do their operations.
Who knows? We might recognize some of that DNA.
Yeah. So anyway, the point I'm raising is we need testable, falsifiable, reproducible, hard evidence. Just because you say you've been abducted by an alien in outer space doesn't mean you can prove it. Maybe it was a nightmare that you had. That's why we need alien DNA, alien chips, anything that you can touch.
but you think that most likely if they're out there, they're operating on such a high plane that we're not even aware of it. Or maybe they're sending robots. Who knows?
Yeah. You know, when you go to a forest and you talk to the forest animals, do you try to engage the squirrels and the deer? Maybe for a little bit, yeah. But after a while, you get bored because they don't talk back to you.
Yeah.
They don't have any interesting stories to tell you. So I think that if aliens come to the Earth, they're so advanced that they could travel thousands of light years to the Earth, and we are like squirrels to them, you know, cute little creatures of the forest, but we have nothing to offer them.
So not they even would Michio Kaku?
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, even if
Surely
they have smart squirrels,
they
may not want to engage us.
Oh. Well, this kind of gets into an interesting chapter where you discuss the four types of civilizations, which are broken down, interestingly, by energy technology. That's not surprising because, as I recall from our last conversation, almost all of the future tech that you discussed, from starships to jetpacks to laser guns, are all possible by the laws of physics, but the only thing holding us back is our ability to harness efficient and, in many cases, compact and transportable energy sources, right?
Right. I'm a physicist and also a futurist, because what do we physicists do? We invent the future. We invented the laser. We invented the transistor. We helped to create the computer, for God's sake. We wrote the World Wide Web. We invented television. We invented radio, microwaves, radar. In the hospital, we invented the X-ray machine, the MRI scan. So we invent the future. So when we look at harebrained inventions of the future, like ray guns and stuff like that, we ask a simple question. Does it violate the laws of physics? And then we begin to realize the shocking realization that most of science fiction does not violate the laws of physics.
Really?
It's an engineering problem. Why don't we have ray guns? Because you need a portable battery, a battery powerful enough to energize a ray gun. That's why we don't have ray guns or flying cars. It's very difficult to create a portable power pack small enough to put inside a car to make it fly. All these are possible, except we have the practical problem, the engineering problem of energy, portable energy. That's why we don't have the jetpacks and the flying cars and the ray guns of science fiction.
Walk us through these different levels of civilization and tell us where we rank. Do we even rank in the bottom civilization?
We rank civilizations by energy. So type one would be planetary. They control the weather. They can control, in principle, earthquakes and volcanoes, anything planetary they control, sort of like Buck Rogers. Then we have type two, stellar. They control the output of a star. They play with stars. That's the Federation of Planets of Star Trek. Then we have type three, which is galactic. They roam the galactic space lanes. They play with black holes like the Empire in the Star Wars series. Now, what are we? Do we play with the weather? Do we tinker with stars? Mm. Do we roam the galactic space lanes? No. We're type...
We have the internet.
We're type zero. We're type zero. But we are about 100 years from becoming type one. For example,
really?
The internet...
Really? That soon, you think?
The internet is the beginning of a type one telephone system. Mm-hmm. So we're privileged to be alive to witness the birth of the first planetary type one telecommunication system called the internet. But we see evidence of this elsewhere. The language. What language will type one people speak 100 years from now? Well, already English and Mandarin Chinese are the two leading languages on the internet. It's already happening. Mm. What is the Olympics? The Olympics is the beginning of a type one sports. What is rock and roll? The beginning of a type one youth culture and music. What is Chanel and Gucci? The beginning of a type one high fashion. And so we're seeing the beginnings of a type one culture emerge because we are headed for a type one civilization. Now, it's not guaranteed because we're type zero. We get our energy from dead plants, oil and coal. We have all the savagery of rising from the swamp just a few hundred years ago, all the sectarian fundamentalist schisms and things like that. It's not guaranteed we're going to make it to type one by the year 2100. That's why Elon Musk has said that, well, maybe they blew themselves up. Maybe that's why they don't land on the Earth, because they never made it from type zero to type one. But once you are type one, you're planetary by the year about 2100. At that point, you'll have plenty of time to iron out all the sectarian fundamentalist nonsense that typified your rise from the swamp.
Mm-hmm. Those things like the sectarian violence and the divisiveness in the world, are those an innate deal breaker to getting to type one?
Possibly. It's not guaranteed. That's the point. It's not guaranteed that we're going to make it from type zero to type one. However, every time I read the newspaper, I look at the headlines, every single headline points to the formation of a type one civilization. I see the internet going everywhere. I see technology. I see languages spreading. I see the Olympics. I see the beginning of a type one culture and a type one technology spreading throughout the planet Earth. Now, it's not guaranteed that we're going to make it. As Elon Musk says, maybe that's why the aliens don't land on the Earth, because they blew themselves up. But I'm optimistic. As President Eisenhower once said, quote, "Generals who are pessimistic never win wars. Only the optimists win wars. Optimists make history.
Well, you are definitely an optimist, and you know who else is? Transhumanists. We kind of touched on that a moment ago. They're the ones who want to be able to download their consciousness to a chip or stop the aging process, suspended animation, that sort of thing. All of these sound great in theory, but are we even close to remotely being able to make those things possible right now? I mean, within my lifetime, to the point that it's useful for me.
Well, we talked about digital immortality, but let's talk about biologic immortality. We're now isolating the genes that control the aging process. We've identified over 60 of these genes. And if you take a look at a car, ask yourself a simple question. Where does aging take place in a car? Mm-hmm. Well, it's the engine, right?
Yeah.
That's where you have moving parts and you have combustion, oxidation. Well, where do we have that in a cell? Well, bingo, the mitochondria, the powerhouse of the cell. And that's where errors build up. We've now located where the wear and tear of aging takes place, and that takes place in the mitochondria. Now, with gene therapy, if you fix those broken genes, in principle, you might be able to live forever.
Before we went on mic, I was telling you that I just had Michael Shermer on discussing somewhat similar topics. He says that he doubts that we'll ever be able to live beyond 125 years max, because even if you find a cure for all the diseases in the world, like you said, your body still atrophies and your cells can only replicate so many times. So
how do we get there? You see, first of all, your skin cells divide about 60 times and then they go into senescence and eventually die. Why? There's a clock. Your clock says time to die. But we've now found a way to stop the clock. It's called telomerase. We can actually immortalize skin cells. Now, that verb, to immortalize, did not exist 10 years ago. But now we regularly immortalize skin cells in California, in Menlo Park. We apply telomerase. So what's the catch? There's always a catch someplace, right? The catch is that cancer cells are also immortal because of telomerase. Now, why does cancer kill you? Cancer kills you precisely because these cells are immortal. They divide forever, forming a tumor, which then chokes off your bodily functions, and then you die. Well, if we can control telomerase and control the buildup of error inside the mitochondria of the cell, in principle, you can live forever. There's no law of physics preventing that.
Well, I mean, not only do we die, but apparently the universe eventually is going to die, you say. You say that it's going to go in one of three ways, a big crunch, a big freeze, or a big rip. Describe those for us.
Well, if you look at Einstein's theory of general relativity, it gives three possible scenarios for the death of the universe. Mm-hmm. As George Harrison of the Beatles once said, all things must pass, including the universe itself. If we have a big bang, perhaps it bangs forever and it gets colder and colder as it expands. That's the big freeze. Then maybe the expansion stops and then contracts on itself and gets hotter and hotter, and that's the big crunch. And then you have an oscillating universe. Maybe it bangs repeatedly. Now, we don't know which way it's going to go, but the evidence points to a big freeze.
Mm-hmm.
The universe is expanding out of control. It's careening out of control. It's expanding without limit. If that continues, then we're all going to freeze to death. That we'll all die when the universe dies. Now, my own personal point of view is as follows. This is going to happen trillions of years from now when we're going to become maybe type 4, extragalactic.
So we got time.
We got time, plenty of time, trillions of years. And on that scale, once we have that kind of cosmic power, then I think we should leave the universe. We should create a tear in the fabric of space and time called the wormhole, create an interdimensional lifeboat, and then sail to another universe, which is warmer, where we can mess up that universe as well.
Well, being a futurist can be a dicey proposition. Look back to the 50s or the 60s, all the things that they envisioned then somehow haven't come to pass, but then nobody ever imagined we'd have the internet or DVD players and those types of things.
Or rockets that go to the moon.
Rockets that go to the moon. Have there been inventions and advances that surprised even you?
Well, first of all, why were the predictions of old wrong? Like in 1900, the most famous prediction was that we'll have blimps, transatlantic blimps that go back and forth between England and the United States. See, what was missing was understanding the basic laws of physics.
Yeah.
There are four forces, the electromagnetic force of light, gravity, and the two nuclear forces. Period. End of story. We didn't know that in 1900. Now we do. So when we make predictions, we'll still make whoppers, we'll still make outrageous predictions, but we're not going to violate the known laws of physics anymore.
Okay.
So that's why our predictions today, yeah, they're going to be silly 100 years from now, but for the most part, they will be correct.
It's just a question of when and how long.
That's right. My attitude is, if it doesn't violate the laws of physics and there's a demand for it, it will happen. And that includes the possibility of immortality.
Well, before we go, last time I talked to you, we talked about your life's work trying to crack Einstein's unified theory. I think this is about 2 years, probably almost to the day, since we talked last. Any progress?
Oh, yeah. You realize that Einstein's dream was to create a unified field theory of everything. Mm-hmm. Today, we think we have it. It's string theory. We're now trying to verify pieces of it, like the Higgs boson that was discovered. The Higgs boson is predicted by string theory, but it's not conclusive yet to prove the theory. We want that one-inch equation that allows you to summarize all the known laws of the physical universe. Now, we have a partial theory, and that's called string field theory, and that's what I did. That one-inch equation is actually my equation, but it's not in its final form. And so I think that, yeah, in the coming years, we will put string theory in its final form and create experiments to measure this theory. That'll clinch it right there.
Do you ever get frustrated and think, maybe I'll just keep with writing books? Well, I should give up.
I realized years ago that I would rather tackle a big problem, big, big problem, and be wrong than do lots of itsy-bitsy little problems and be right. So you don't get any emotional satisfaction publishing 50 papers that everyone forgets the next day.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the thrill of that? It's much better to say, I tried. I tried to tackle the big one. Maybe I didn't get there, but hey, it was a lot of fun. And my attitude is, if it's not fun, don't do it.
Well, kids, I hope you're listening. Once more, the book is called The Future of Humanity, Terraforming Mars, Interstellar Travel, Immortality, and Our Destiny Beyond Earth. Professor Michio Kaku, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you, and it's now a New York Times bestseller.
Go get it. Thanks again to Michio Kaku for coming on the podcast. Order his book, The Future of Humanity, Terraforming Mars, Interstellar Travel, Immortality, and Our Destiny Beyond Earth on Amazon or Audible. Keep up with him at his website, mkaku.org, that's M-K-A-K-U, and follow him on Twitter at Michio Kaku. If you're an entrepreneur, a small business owner, or even if you have a side gig, let me introduce you to Grasshopper, the entrepreneur's phone system. Grasshopper lets you send and receive calls and texts from your new business phone number. That way, you can run your business from anywhere and respond to clients quickly with Grasshopper's mobile apps. Grasshopper. Sign up today. Go to grasshopper.com/kick to get $20 off your first month. Again, that's grasshopper.com/kick. Hulu just released a new original, The Looming Tower, based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning book by Lawrence Wright. This limited series traces the rising threat of Osama bin Laden and how the rivalry between the FBI and CIA may have set a path for the tragedy of 9/11. The Looming Tower is available now only on Hulu. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.